94 WGTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we're going to be hearing about a brand new thriller. There are moments in the interview when the cell phone signal is a little bit weak, but these moments are fleeting, fortunately, and we hope that you'll still enjoy the interview despite its technical shortcomings. In part two of today's program, from the archives, a conversation with the author of a very popular children's book called A Boy and His Jaguar. Again, this is the Monday morning show on WGTD, and here is part one. Well, I need to begin this interview with a strange fact that I felt a certain sort of nervousness this morning as I got to work and got into the elevator. And it is thanks to a marvelous novel that I have been reading called Elevator Pitch, which in a sense does for elevators what Jaws did for ocean waters. That is, it gets us thinking in a new way about the danger that might perhaps be lurking in an elevator that we might take nearly every day. That is at the heart of a suspense novel, a thriller, that is beautifully crafted by bestselling author Linwood Barclay. 18 previous novels to his credit, and a couple of thrillers for children. You perhaps know such novels as No Time for Goodbye, or the screenplay adaptation for his novel Never Saw It Coming, and The Accident. And this novel is published by William Morrow. Again, it's titled Elevator Pitch. And Linwood Barclay, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much. It's delightful to be here.
So I am excited to talk with you about this novel, which is so scary and so suspenseful and in a lot of different ways. I want to ask first, though, in the biography that appears at the back of your book, it makes mention of the fact that you have written two thrillers for children. Would you elaborate on what those books are like and what it means to write thrillers for children?
Well, you know, books were called Chase and Escape, and they came out a couple of years ago, and they were about a very special dog who was being outfitted by a secret institute with all sorts of software and so forth that would allow this dog to be used as a kind of a surveillance or a counterintelligence agent. So he knows enough, he understands language, all those sort of things, and because you know, if you want to do some spying, I mean, who pays attention to a dog going by? So, but of course, the problem was with this particular dog was that the software wasn't working well enough to override his canine instincts, and he could be pursuing somebody and see a squirrel and still go after the squirrel. So they decided they had to get rid of him, put him down, and he knew they were going to do that, so he was still smart enough to figure out how to escape, which he does, and then goes looking for a special boy, and we don't know why he's looking for this boy. So while he's looking for this boy, this secret institute is out to find them. That's the premise of those two books.
Wow.
Fun to do.
And I guess children need some suspense in their lives and in their reading lives as well.
Oh, yeah. And, And, you know, all the same principles that I try to, you know, apply to the adult thrillers, I apply to the kids one. You want it to be a page turner. You want it to have a sense of momentum. You want it just, whatever the age, you just want the person to keep turning that page.
Hmm. Well, let's turn our attention to this book that I have been reading that now has me feeling a little bit nervous each and every time I get onto an elevator. I should also add that about 6 months ago, I had the disconcerting experience for the first time in my life of being on an elevator at another place, where at the college where I work, and of the elevator stopping and then only opening about 4 inches and then just stopping. And of having to decide, I get my hands in there and open these doors the rest of the way manually, which I ultimately did.
Oh, no.
I walked off, and then about 10 minutes later, after I'd placed a phone call, there was a sign saying defective elevator on the door of this elevator to keep anyone else from going. But it was so interesting to think about how an elevator is something that we don't think a lot about, but we are very vulnerable in elevators.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why it's the heart of your novel. Before we get to the framework of your novel, talk a little bit about the reality of elevators and what prompted you to make elevators the central focus of this wonderful novel.
Well, you know, I would love to be able to say I had an experience like yours or something personally that you know, terrified me, but I had been listening to the news in Toronto, where I live, and Toronto has the skyline has transformed there over the last decade. It looks more like Hong Kong. About 50 condo towers have gone up. And as a result, the city did not have enough elevator inspectors. And they hadn't had a catastrophe yet, but they didn't want one. But they just didn't have enough people to check them out. And the idea was just there in my head instantly. What if you had a guy who, for whatever reason, was dispatching his victims by sabotaging elevators? And the idea seemed so kind of out there. And so I actually was talking to my agent later that day, and I said, you know, I had this idea. And she said, oh, my God, you have to start writing that immediately. It's such a great idea for a thriller. And it's a bit like, remember that Seinfeld episode where Kramer decided to do a coffee table book on coffee tables? So my elevator pitch for elevator pitch is that you've got some guy who's sending elevators and pitching them right down to the bottom of the shaft. So it's a bit kind of like that. What I discovered is that there's a kind of intersection of phobias where elevators are concerned. And a lot of people are just freaked out by them. There's claustrophobia, fear of falling, fear of heights, loss of control. And also a lot of people just don't like getting into a crowded little box with a whole lot of people. And so all these phobias come together when you get into one of those boxes.
Right, exactly. And, of course, a big difference, too, and I suppose I should be a little embarrassed, I suppose I am, to say that the elevator I took here at work is only for two floors, one and two, but it's because I was just really heavy laden with lots of stuff today. And likewise, the college where I do, it's actually three floors, but it's the only way to get from my building to the library. So you actually sort of have to take the elevator unless you walk way around outside. But anyway, but it's a whole nother thing when you are in a high rise in a city like Manhattan, and we're talking about elevators that travel 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 floors. It is a different journey, a different experience, and there are also certain risks and dangers that are involved.
Oh yeah, and you know, in the novel, of course, which takes place in Manhattan, once there has been, there's been rather coincidentally, it seems at first, a series of these mishaps, and by the time you have a third one in one week, something that's going on in some place behind this. And imagine a city like New York, if the word goes out, it may not be safe to get into that elevator. What that does to a vertical city like that, it just kind of sends it into chaos. And, if you don't work on the 50th floor, you might live on the 50th floor. And so if you're already up there, do you come down? And if you're on the street level, do you go up? What do you do? And so that's also much about what happens in this novel.
We're speaking with Linwood Barclay, and we're talking about his novel, which is called Elevator Pitch. And the central premise of the novel, as we've already touched on, is that on a certain Monday, there is a elevator mishap in a Manhattan office tower. and several people are killed. And it's a sad but also, in a sense, not particularly remarkable incident, except that something like it happens on Tuesday and something like it happens on Wednesday. And at one point, as investigations begin, you actually are able to share with us some statistics that I assume are valid statistics about just the rate of frequency with which people are either killed or injured in elevator mishaps.
That's right. And they are actually very rare. Elevator accidents are very rare. And those who do end up getting killed in them are more often than not elevator repair people, technicians. So they're the ones who are already in the shaft doing maintenance work, and then something happens or they lose their grip or they trip. So most of the people are those who work in the industry, but not exclusively. And so it does happen occasionally. There was a horrible accident in Manhattan about 5 weeks ago, but coincidentally. And but the other thing that I learned is that, of course, that the people have this misconception. They think that if they are in a plunging elevator, that they can save themselves by, at the last moment, jumping up. And I'm here to tell you that will not work. So for two reasons. One is, of course, you have no idea when you're going to hit the bottom. You don't know when you could jump. And even if you did, you're still falling at the same rate of speed as that elevator. So it's not going to help you. The best thing a person can do is to distribute their weight. So if they lie on the floor and spread out your arms and legs and distribute your body weight to lessen the damage to yourself. Which, of course, is not very helpful advice if you happen to be on an elevator with 15 other people.
Right.
In which case, I would tell all of them, you guys all lie down, I'll get on top of you. That would be my... But there's not usually enough time to organize something like that.
Right. And, of course, and what we are talking about in the incidents that occur in your novel are rather inexplicable incidents in which, in most cases at least, the elevator is not behaving at all the way it should. I mean, it's not even normal malfunctioning, but something that grows more sinister the more we learn about what is going wrong with these elevators all over Manhattan. I want to say that this novel, which is so suspenseful, is full of really, really fascinating and complicated characters, including the fictional mayor and many of them around him, and a couple of detectives and a journalist, all complicated, interesting characters. Just say a word about what guides you as you craft a character for a novel, and what is most important for you in making them more than just kind of predictable caricatures.
Yeah, and you know, whenever I ever am doing a thriller, it's always the kind of what if, it's the situation first. And once I have that kind of hook, then I'd start writing, turn my attention to the characters. And I often have a pretty good sense of them very early on, of what they're like, and start developing that as I go along. And I guess the big thing is if you try not to make them caricatures, you try to make them complicated, to make them not entirely good or not entirely bad, because this, for example, the mayor comes across as, you know, some of a jerk in many instances, and yet there's a scene in the book when he's dealing with a young boy who was trapped in one of these elevators, and the cameras aren't on, nobody sees him, and he's wonderful with this kid. And so you think, okay, maybe he's not 100% a jerk. There's something else there. And Barbara Matheson, who is this political online, she's an online columnist on a website writing about New York political affairs. And she's, you know, striving to expose hypocrisy and the things that politicians do wrong. And yet her own life, she's somewhat of a hypocrite. I mean, she's doesn't mind taking shots at people for not living up to their obligations, and yet she doesn't do them with her own daughter. And so there's, exactly that's the best thing you can do with characters is kind of give them shading. They're not all just one thing or another.
Give them shading. Give them contradictory traits or just make them complicated the way most of us are complicated if we look beneath the surface. Right.
We're very good at especially in the social media world, of reducing everybody down to one simple thing, like, oh, you feel this way about this, you must be really bad. But that's not necessarily the case, you know? I mean, I was in some sort of political discussion with someone the other day, and we were at opposite ends of the spectrum. And then we found out we had all these other common interests, that we were just nuts about this thing or that thing. And we thought, maybe we should just talk about that and skip the other stuff, because it turns out we're being often more alike than what we realize.
One of the primary suspicions when it comes to who might be behind this spate of incidents across Manhattan is that it might be the work of a domestic terrorist organization, or that is at least the way they are viewed by many, called the Flyovers. I am not familiar with such an organization, so I am assuming this is a product of your own fertile imagination, but certainly rooted in reality in terms of some of the attitudes that are dividing our country right now. Tell our listeners about this organization called the Flyovers and what draws suspicion to them.
So, yes, they created this sort of this group, and they identify themselves as that. Of course, you know, we talk about flyover country and the coastal elites types and so forth, they say. So it's all these folks who get on a plane in New York, and then they go to L.A., and everything else in America is the stuff that they fly over, and it's kind of it becomes a kind of metaphor. These are, you know, these sort of folks don't care about the middle of the country. They care about their own issues and so forth. So this is a group that really has its origins in that's what you would call flyover country, and they take on that name as a kind of badge of honor, and they are believed or thought to be behind some bombing incidents and so forth that have happened on coastal cities. And it is a product of my imagination, but it does grow out of the kind of political animosity that seems to exist these days. And, you know, and a lot of the sort of group, the complaints that the flyovers might have about the other folks in the country, they're based in kind of fact. A lot of them are legitimate. It is kind of part of the world, part of the country that is often ignored and not considered. And I wove them into the novel, because we have all sorts of potential suspects when it comes to the question of New York elevators.
Right. And, of course, this real possibility, it makes sense that a place like New York City and the people who live there would be a very logical target for someone who bears this kind of animosity and resentment towards what they call coastal elites. And that is also woven into your suspenseful novel. One point about your writing that I want to be sure to ask you about, and it's something that I really appreciate, is that in many cases in the novel, a really important revelation is given to us in very sparse fashion, that is, with very few and ordinary words, and it's often the last sentence of a chapter where there is just sort of a bare-bones, plain-spokenness about the way this shocking revelation will be given. And I don't know if that's a common device among writers of novels like this. This is actually not the kind of novel I typically turn to. I really don't read a lot of fiction, actually. But I was really struck by how effective that was and how effective it was over and over again in this novel. Is that something you consciously do?
It is. What I tend to do is because it is a thriller and you want it to have this sense of momentum and you want people to keep turning the pages, my goal is to try to end a chapter with something that makes you go, oh my gosh, that happened, or we now know this. And so you feel like, well, before I try to fall asleep, I will read just one more chapter. And And, you know, it's a lot of times when I'm writing, I think, well, what's the logical way that this chapter should end, or you would expect it to end? And is there a way that I can make that not happen and give you something else with the chapter? And, you know, the thing is, I'm kind of, you know, I'm a kid of the 60s and the 70s who was addicted to television, to whether it was Mission Impossible or Mannix or The Man from Uncle. I mean, I just loved all those shows. And I always feel like chapter endings are like when they go to commercial. Every time you would watch it, you know, as a kid, you would watch this, and it would be now, you know, 15 minutes after the hour, and it's the first break after Act One, and something big happens. And you think, oh, my gosh, I just enough time to run to the bathroom or go get a snack, and I have to get back here. And I think that kind of, that made an impression on me even as a kid. And so when I am writing, I want to end a chapter in that sort of a way, that you have to come back.
A last question. One of the main characters in your novel is a detective by the name of Jerry Burke. And he has, I suppose we might in a sense call it a quirk, an interesting twist to his persona, namely that when he finds himself getting stressed, and Lord knows there's all kinds of stress involved in his work, he has to often reach for an inhaler. Because right. he becomes short of breath, and it's fascinating. And one of the sort of subplots of the novel is the way that he is contending with this reality, and we only learn incrementally what is behind this. Did anything in particular prompt you to create this facet of this very interesting character?
Well, part of it was I had an idea for a scene that's very, very late in the novel, which I can't give away, and I don't want to because it would be a spoiler. But I thought, imagine, you know, here we have a novel where at some point you figure people are going to have to take the stairs, and they might have to take an awful lot of them to like Manhattan because it's not safe. I thought, what if one of the people who had to do that is someone who is suffering from shortness of breath when they get stressed out? And so those two things came together in my head, and I thought, I'm going to give this particular character a kind of sort of a PTSD problem, that when he is stressed out, he gets short of breath. Because I thought, I can make that pay off big time later in the novel. And that was really my thinking. And it also, on top of all that, more than it just being, say, a plot gimmick, it does really allow us to get deeply into Jerry's character and what makes him tick and the things that he has been through. And the other thing that's very interesting about that particular character is he's fascinated by New York architecture and buildings, and he makes in his, you know, his small apartment where he lives alone, he makes sort of cardboard replicas of some of the most iconic buildings in Manhattan. So he knows a little bit about them. And when we get to a sort of very big climactic finish, he has a little bit of a head start on what he may be up against when he has to enter this one particular building.
Right. You tell us at one point in the book that he didn't make it into architecture school, which is why he ultimately then went into law enforcement, a common job in his own family tree. But clearly there is a first love for him, and it is the way big buildings are put together and so on. And this comes to be a crucial bit of knowledge for him as he and others work to try to crack this terrifying case of all of these elevators across Manhattan that
when one of the very scenes where we first get to know him is in the Strand bookstore in Manhattan buying, you know, sort of architectural books, photos of New York in the early years and what the street scenes were like. He's very into that kind of thing.
Right. And I like that about him. And I find so many of the characters in this novel to be complex and really, really compelling. And that adds immeasurably to the effectiveness of this novel. The novel, again, is titled Elevator Pitch. It's published by William Morrow. And it is incredibly suspenseful. And I highly recommend it. And its author, Linwood Barclay. Linwood Barclay, congratulations on a terrific book. And thank you for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
The time is 8:34, and you're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Before part two, we want to remind you of Wisconsin Public Radio's fall membership drive. If you enjoy the programming you hear over WGTD, including the morning show, please make a contribution to their membership drive online at WPR.org or by calling 1-888-202-2552. And thank you for your support. 8:35 now the time, exactly. And now something from the morning show archives. I'm so excited that we can spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about an absolutely beautiful, heartwarming children's book called A Boy and a Jaguar. And what's especially moving about this book is that it springs from a real-life story. In many respects, it tells the story of my morning show guest and the author of this book, A Boy and, a Jaguar, Alan Rabinowitz, who is an ardent wildlife conservationist, zoologist, president and founder of Panthera, a nonprofit organization which seeks to protect the world's wildcats. He's written a number of different articles that have appeared in National Geographic Explorer, Audubon, Scientific American, among other publications. Also part of Alan Rabinowitz's interesting story is the fact that he is a stutterer and an advocate for stutterers. And it is, oddly enough, in his communication with and his work with animals that, in a sense, his stuttering has been largely tamed. And that is part of the heartwarming story of this beautiful children's book called A Boy and a Jaguar, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And we have Alan Rabinowitz joining us on the phone to talk about his story and this beautiful new children's book. Alan Rabinowitz, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So this lovely children's book is, in many respects, your autobiography of sorts. Is it, in fact, entirely autobiographical, or are there any significant ways in which the boy and ultimately the man we meet in this book, are there ways in which he is different from who you actually are and the life you have lived?
No, this is the most autobiographical book I've written yet. It's my first children's book, and it's my way of trying to get out some of the angst and early feelings that I actually had as a child. And to try to express to young people how things that may be handicaps when you're young or the way people view you could in fact lead to incredible strengths and incredible doors towards realizing your dreams.
Mm. So as we open up this book, we meet a young boy, and it's you in the Bronx Zoo whispering to one of the caged wild cats there. And we learn by the second page of the book that you are a stutterer, because as you turn around to try to talk to your father, in your words, "I try to explain, but my mouth freezes just as I knew it would. I am a stutterer. If I try to push words out, my head and body shake uncontrollably." Tell us more about stuttering, how it entered your life, at what point? I mean, was it part of you from the very beginning? And how did it first manifest itself?
Well, there was never a time in my life when I remember being able to speak. My earliest recollections of childhood were the inability to communicate, were the inability to actually get out more than a few words until my mouth would freeze, so to speak. And I would, my kind of stuttering wasn't the repetitious kind. It was what they used to call frozen mouth, where I would have blocks and hard contacts. And
I would spasm and sputter and spit trying to get the words out, and they wouldn't come. And the more people got anxious about it, the more I got anxious about it, and it just didn't work. At a point, I just even stopped trying, because adults back then, this was before the time of computers, of the internet, so you couldn't just go online and find out about stuttering or who other stutterers might be. So I was alone in this world. Although when I was put in special classes in New York City at the time, they didn't quite understand stuttering as well as they do now, and they thought it was purely a psychological problem. They didn't understand other things either about ADHD or dyslexia or autism. So we were all put, as children, in special classes that, of course, the other kids would make fun of and call the retarded classes.
Mm. You make mention, and I just read the description on the second page of your book, where you say, "I am a stutterer. If I try to push words out, my head and body shake uncontrollably." Tell us more about that. What would that look like? I mean, did that look like an epileptic seizure, or in some other way, did that? Can you help us understand what you were experiencing and what people would have seen if they had seen you in a moment like that?
Well, that's really an interesting question, because I didn't see myself, as bad as I knew it was, I never realized how other people saw it until I was finally accepted into an experimental clinic years later, and they took a movie tape of me and played it back to me, and I was shocked at the way I looked. It did look like an epileptic seizure. It did look like, so I couldn't understand why people misinterpreted things so badly, because I was normal inside my own head, but I just couldn't get the words out. Once when I was in a grocery store, I was holding up the line trying to say my last name for a bag of groceries that was sitting behind the counter, and the person at the cash register just said, "Please excuse him, he's retarded, he can't function." So I actually thought, okay, I'll act like that. But I never realized that I was looking very handicapped to the outside world. It didn't look good. And I never knew that, because back then, also, video cameras weren't that common. There were no video cameras. There were movie cameras. And once people took a movie of me and showed it back, I was shocked at how I looked.
This helps explain what is described in your book about you being put in a class for disturbed children. "He's not disturbed," my parents say. "We're sorry," the teachers answer, "but whenever he tries to speak, he disrupts the class." In a sense, what you're saying is that was true. Not that you should have necessarily been sequestered in a class for disturbed children, but in fact, you were a source of at least distraction in the classroom when these episodes would occur.
That's absolutely right, and I didn't blame the teacher. I never blamed them. I still don't to this day. Unless if they understand it better, they can deal with it better. But it really was a huge distraction for the class, and I was glad to be out of those classes and into the classes with the other special ed kids, where I felt much more comfortable. But I knew I was normal inside. I really didn't understand why people just couldn't see that I was normal inside, but I didn't hold against them the fact that I couldn't function the way all the other children function, so they would kind of not call on me or put me aside. I didn't fault them for that. It just added to the feeling that I didn't belong in that world.
Mm.
And that's why when I'd go home, I would talk to my animals and create my own world.
Mm. You had, at least according to this book, you had a hamster, a gerbil, a green turtle, a chameleon, and a garter snake. And you say, "Every day I come home from class and go straight to the closet in my room. I bring out my pets and I close the door and talk to them without stuttering." Is there an explanation for why your stuttering would disappear when you were talking to your pets?
There is, and it wouldn't. To be fair, it would not disappear 100%, but I could get out thoughts and sentences. I would still stutter some, because what we know now is that stuttering is not purely a psychological phenomenon. Stuttering is actually it's genetically based with the nerves, the neurons that are involved in speech not all functioning properly. And that manifests itself in the speech not coming out smoothly. But then what happens is that when the speech doesn't come out smoothly, as the child gets more nervous and tries to push it out, push through the hard contacts, then the psychological component comes in, and you just get more and more frustrated. All your muscles tense up, and you start spasming and getting worse and worse. If you eliminate that psychological component to where you're relaxed, when I could speak to the animals, I had no tension in me. I felt there was no expectation that I had to be normal or a certain way, so I wasn't nervous with them. The stutters would still come, but I could move through them because it wouldn't get worse and worse, as adults would stare at me and say, okay, calm down, or speed up, or stop thinking. So some adults thought I was thinking too slow. Some thought I would be trying to think too fast. They had no idea, and that just made me very confused and frustrated as a child. Animals had no expectations, so I could get through the words.
And as you describe this, as we get to page 5 or 6 of the book, you write, "I know that my pets listen and understand. Animals can't get the words out, just as I can't get the words out. So people ignore or misunderstand or hurt them, the same way people ignore or misunderstand or hurt me. I make a promise to my pets. I promise that if I can ever find my voice, I will be their voice and keep them from harm." At what age are we talking about that you started to kind of make that connection and started looking to the future with that possibility in mind?
That was about 7 or 8. I remember very clearly. At first, it was all about me, of course. It was about using my pets in order to express myself, having them be my captive audience with no expectations. It was about me. But over time, even as a young child, I knew they didn't understand my words per se, but I also realized, which now I know is true, that animals understand your feelings. They feel the energy. They understand your emotions. Even some of the smallest, simplest animals, they go with what you're feeling and react to it. And I realized several years into having animals as my only solace that, wait a second, these animals have feelings also. And they just can't express it. They have their own languages, their own way of expressing things to each other, but they can't express it in a human voice. And we would treat them so differently. I mean, people would forget to feed their green turtles and they would die, or the water would dry up, or the chameleons would die, or people would get tired of their pets and flush goldfish down the toilet bowl. And even today, we euthanize our dogs and cats because it's a bit expensive to do surgery on them or to care for them at a vet. We would be treating them very, very differently, even at zoos, if we had zoos at all. If the animals had a human voice and said, please, I don't want to be here, or please, I don't want to die.
Or I don't want to do that. I mean,
I don't want to do that, exactly.
Right. You talk about getting through school by learning tricks that stutterers learn, various strategies, I suppose, for contending with this, I suppose, for to some extent hiding the condition or minimizing it. But it sounds like the real breakthrough came while you were in college. Describe to our listeners this experimental program and the difference that it made for you?
Well, I was still a severe stutterer all the way up to being a senior in college, and I was 19 at the time, because I always, in order to prove I was normal to people, I would try to excel in academics and excel in sports. So I entered college at 16, and I was graduating at 19, but none of that mattered. It was all about whether I could speak or not. But as a senior in college, I'd never gone out on a date. I'd never kissed a girl other than my mom. My life had just not been very good and not been very average. And my mother, my parents had tried all kinds of other treatments. They didn't know what to do either, and they weren't very wealthy people. But they paid for hypnosis to try that, and we tried drug therapy, and even once tried electroshock therapy, because the idea was maybe they could shock my brain the way they reset a computer. Nobody knew what to do with stuttering. And finally, my mother heard about an experimental program where they teach you to manipulate your mouth. The first thing was they taught you that you were a stutterer, that you would always be a stutterer. It's like losing an arm and denying that you only have one arm instead of two. You are a stutterer, and you will always be a stutterer, which was a major thing for me to accept, because I had always expected that one day I would figure out how to be a normal speaker, somehow knock it back in my head. Once I accepted that, I could move beyond that. And then I could use these tools so that whenever there were hard contacts in my mouth, I could try to move through them. Now, those tools didn't come easy. It's like any tools. They've got to be used, and you've got to know what to do with them. And I spent tens of thousands of hours literally practicing with my mouth movements and exaggerated motions in front of a mirror by myself. Many people couldn't do that or didn't do that and went backwards even after this clinic. But I just refused to fail, because once I was given the ability to manipulate my speech, I was determined, like everything else in life, that I would prove to people I could do it. So I became a fluent stutterer. And now I have those tools. I'm not using them. It's very difficult using them all the time, because we have to think about, stutterers think about their speech constantly, much unlike normal speakers. And if I were to use those tools, which I'm doing partly now as we're talking, I have to think about what I'm saying, how I'm saying it, where the hard contacts are coming and moving through them, as I'm also thinking about what I'm going to say to you. And that takes a huge amount of effort and energy. It's gotten easier over the years, and I can do it almost flawlessly. But if I do what I'm doing with you right now all day long, I'm exhausted.
I would think that would be a very wearying day. And you write, too, in your book, there's one very intriguing spread where we see these words, "I can speak." Now you've gone through this program in college, but nothing has changed on the inside. I still feel broken. What began to change that, your inner sense of brokenness, was the work that you did in the wild, first studying black bears and then studying jaguars in the wild. Tell our listeners about the dramatic moment in your book when you describe a very important moment in the nation of in the city of Belize, when it became very important for you to say exactly the right words in exactly the right way.
Well, that was really a defining moment for me. I had learned as a senior in college how to control my speech better, but I was still in the early years not that well practiced in it. So if I got tired or nervous, some severe stuttering would return even if I tried to control it. I was working on jaguars. I was given the opportunity after graduate school to be the first person ever to try to capture and study jaguars in the wild, in the tropical jungle of this new nation of Belize, which had been previously British Honduras. There were jaguars all over, no protected areas. But as I was studying them, my job was just to study them. But I could see that people were killing them. And they were being wiped out as I was studying them, even though they had no protection and they had no protective status. So I remembered my promise, and I felt that even though it wasn't part of my job at the time, that I had to take it a step further and try to save these animals, try to give them a home. So I asked if I could appear before the Prime Minister and talk about my jaguar work. He ended up calling a cabinet meeting and gave me 15 minutes. They gave me permission, not because they were interested in my jaguar work, but because they had heard this story about a crazy foreigner who was capturing jaguars, drugging them and putting radio collars on them and then following them in the jungle. They wanted to know more about that. I had only 15 minutes in front of the Prime Minister and the entire cabinet of the country to kind of put on a show for them. But in my mind, I had to convince them to try to save jaguars. Well, I was really nervous because I knew I couldn't stutter. If I stuttered, they would start looking at my stutter and wondering about my credibility and wondering why I was that way. And I didn't want to put on a stuttering show for them. I had to explain about jaguars.
Mm.
So I put everything into it, and I changed 15 minutes into an hour. They just wouldn't break because they ended up becoming so fascinated by what I was telling them. And by the end of that, I walked out, and they voted, and we had the world's first and only jaguar sanctuary set up in the country of Belize.
It's a wonderful climax to a really powerful story. In our closing minute or two, I wonder if you could just say a word about choosing to tell your story in this way, in a children's book. I wonder if this was trickier. I mean, it's beautifully done, but did it prove to be a trickier challenge than maybe you anticipated at the onset? I think a lot of people assume writing a children's book is pretty simple.
No, it was. You're right. It was both trickier and more painful. It was more painful because I really had to go back to that little broken boy deep inside of me, which sadly didn't take a lot of effort. But I also had to write it in the language of that boy. I really had to go back and bring that boy out, not just the memories of it, but the boy talking to other children. I've always wanted to write a children's book because the future of our earth, the future of wildlife and our environment is going to be changed or not changed by the young people, not by the adults living now, but by the children, and how they either influence their parents or what kind of thoughts they have themselves. So I wanted to convey to young people, and all young people have some period in their life where they feel misunderstood or treated badly, or maybe, unfortunately, they're born with some kind of handicap like stuttering. This is not a book about stuttering. It's a book about a boy who stutters and saves a jaguar. But what I was trying to convey is that any kind of misfortune or any feelings of being misunderstood can be changed into strength inside of you, can be changed into a way to pursue dreams and passions.
Mm.
And that's what I want young people to know.
That is so important for them to be reminded of. And this book is beautifully written and beautifully illustrated as well. Published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, A Boy and a Jaguar. Alan Rabinowitz, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your lovely book.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And tomorrow on The Morning Show, Dr. Art Sear joins us, director of the Clawson Center at Carthage College. He joins us once a month to offer his analysis of current events and issues. I also want to remind you that The Morning Show is now offered as a podcast 7 days a week. And we had a couple of very special offerings over this weekend. On Saturday, we replayed my Morning Show conversation from just over 20 years ago. My conversation on September 20th, 1999, with local author Michael Schumacher. That program was actually a memorial tribute to my predecessor as Morning Show host, a longtime WGTD news director, Bill Guy, who died on the 20th of September back in 1999. You can hear that memorable conversation about the art of the interview and our tribute to Bill Guy by listening to Saturday's podcast. And the Sunday podcast is also in honor of Bill. It is a conversation which he himself conducted some years earlier with then Carthage College baseball coach Augie Schmidt, talking about his long distinguished career in baseball. The Morning Show podcast is available on all of the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcast, and Apple Podcast. Make sure that you search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg to enjoy not only the morning shows that are broadcast Monday through Friday, but also special morning show offerings on Saturday and Sunday.